You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everybody. We are live with you today, and I'm so excited to actually facilitate this conversation among some great friends and some really smart people today here at Brookings. I'm Nicole Turner Lee. I'm a senior fellow in governance studies and the director of the Center for Technology Innovation. And I'm really excited to actually have this conversation because in addition to the fact that I am writing a book, for those of you who follow me on Twitter and at Brookings and on LinkedIn and perhaps on Facebook, my book is forthcoming next year. It is on the U.S. digital divide, and it's about how the internet is essentially creating a digital scope swath of people simply because of the systemic inequalities that overlay their experiences. That's coming out of Brookings Press. And if you know me really well, you know the other thing I'm quite interested in is this intersection of race, technology, and social justice. And we've been talking about that through a series of conversations on racial equity and technology. And if you know me even better, you'd know that artificial intelligence, particularly algorithmic bias, and how we actually deploy these models in the real world matter to me. And over the course of the last couple of years, we at Brookings, we've taken this quite seriously. At the institutional level, we have a great program that is designed around effective scholarship and leadership in this space, whether it's on AI governance, AI bias, in which I lead, or national security. And we even have added to Tech Tank, which is at the core of our blog at the Center for Technology Innovation, a podcast, the Tech Tank podcast, which really looks at these issues in more detail. My co-host, Daryl West, and I have been really getting it in lately with these issues that matter the most. And so today we're going to do something that I think all of us who are on this call today and watching us by video today, we're going to look at algorithmic bias and algorithms in general, but we're going to look at something that I've been talking about for a very long time, which are rating systems, as well as what we're seeing getting done across the globe in terms of certification or labeling. And why is that particularly important? We are now in a state where all of this information that is being collected about us, not just the billions of variables before, but now even more than that, right? Because we all have been home or we've been enjoying our movies or shopping or reading and doing all these things. They're now being collected in a way where the optimization of that information for bias is likely. And I thought before the pandemic that we should sort of think about how do we develop a feedback loop that actually allows developers as well as those who license algorithms to really think about how effective the performance is of that particular model. Now, I'm a sociologist. I'm not a quantitative modeler, nor am I a scientist. But I do know one thing, and this is something that stood out. I'm so happy that my friend Frieda Poli is here today because we sat on a panel maybe a couple years ago where our guy, Jason Oxman, made a comment. And he made a comment that the universe of commerce, for example, has changed to the extent that it is upon companies to win back the trust of people like you and I. Mm-hmm. And so this rating system idea, this Energy Star rating that I'll talk more about later in the panel, is really driven by that. So I'm excited today to have some scholars who are actually out there, whether at the legal level, the design level, the government level, really trying to unpack what would this look like and maybe offer critique on what we have seen happen in the EU and other places. I'm going to introduce them in the order in which I see them. They may look different to you, but I'm going to just ask them to raise their hand. I'm joined today by Mark McCarthy, who is a senior fellow for the Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy at Georgetown. I'm joined by Frieda Poli, who is the CEO and founder of Pymetrics, which I'm excited to have her. I've been trying to get her for about a year. She had a baby last year, so I couldn't get her this time. She's here. Elham Tabassi, my new friend, who is actually the chief of staff of information technology laboratory at NIST, who is actually the governing body of standards when we look at artificial intelligence, and my colleague, John Villasenor, non-resident fellow of governance studies, who's doing absolutely fantastic work at UCLA. Thank you, everybody, for being here. I want to jump in first, Mark, with you, because I know you follow a lot of this stuff. In fact, you and I are aligned when it comes to things like differential treatment or disparate impact. We've seen this before. So before we jump into a conversation that really begins to unpack what we think we're seeing, why don't you take us back historically on how certification, licensing, labeling, and perhaps ratings actually existed in the past?
Sure. Thanks very much, Nicole. And thank you for having me. This promises to be a really fun conversation, and I'm glad to be joined by all the other wonderful panelists who will carry on the conversation with us. So I'm not going to give you any kind of comprehensive history, but I do want to cite a couple of examples, and maybe we can learn some lessons from these examples about the possibility of rating systems and labeling for machine learning programs and algorithms more generally. So the first one that I want to remind people of is something called P3P, which is a privacy operation that started maybe 20 years ago, when people were worried about online privacy, and they thought maybe we could get a rating system where websites would be matched with the preferences, the privacy preferences of their users. A system was attempted to be developed, and it didn't finally get into place, and we'll talk about why that might have been in a moment. A second one in a similar vein was a do not track proposal. It was the idea that that companies should get together in a standard setting operation and set up a technical standard that would allow users to opt out of online tracking. And once again, it didn't come to anything. And the third example actually got off the ground. It was called the V-chip, and it was a requirement where the government said you got to put these chips in TV sets, and it required broadcasters to transmit rating codes for violence and sex and language, and that would allow parents to block certain programs. The broadcasters used their own judgment about what the ratings were, but the rest of it was a mandatory program. Now, in AI and machine learning, a vast number of systems have been proposed for ethics, and there's a whole cottage industry of doing ethical impact statements. But the idea of a seal of good housekeeping approval or nutrition labeling or a rating system, that is not well developed, and it really is worth pursuing. And I hope this conversation can help it move off the dime and begin to be more widely discussed. I have two reservations, though. One is the element of coercion. The P3P and the do not track systems failed because of a lack of industry buy-in. This kind of thing would really need to be made mandatory. Otherwise, industry has really no incentive to come to agreement on the system or to use it if it happens to be adopted. The second reservation is that even with coercion, the objective of an AI rating system is to give consumers and users more information about these systems. And to be honest, that might not be enough. Think about content moderation for a moment. Social media platforms, they label their content often so people can avoid it if they want or discount it. But obviously, they should do a whole lot more on their own. They shouldn't be carrying hate speech or white nationalist content. These content rules are obviously best set by the private sector, not by government agencies, but they should do more than just label objectionable content. They might also want to be responsible enough to restrict it entirely. Now, most uses of algorithms don't raise these kind of expression questions. So government agencies might usefully raise questions about the intended use of algorithms, not just whether they're doing what they are doing in a fair and unbiased way, but whether what they are doing is worth doing at all. This is the kind of question that Frank Pasquale raises in what he calls the second wave of algorithmic accountability. And that idea of assessing the actual purposes and uses of algorithms, that's worth pursuing as well.
Yeah. You know, I love what you're talking about, and it's so funny, and I'm going to pivot over to John. And before I forget, please tweet this conversation, hashtag AI bias. And if you have questions, we will have time during this conversation to go to them. Please send them via email to events@brookings.edu, events@brookings.edu. So, John, I love what Mark is talking about, right? Because I have gotten pushback, and some people have heard me talk about this Energy Star ratings, right, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. And part of that came from, I don't know if she's watching, but we were doing a paper a couple of years ago, a woman by the name of Jeannie Barton, who was at the Better Business Bureau, was actually talking about the BBB certification process. And as we delved into the paper that we actually put out at Brookings with another author, Paul Resnick, an engineer, it appeared to me that we don't have anything that sort of suggests, because as Mark said, we don't know what's under the hood, you know, whether or not this algorithm is performing in the way that it's supposed to. And that particular time I was writing that paper, my dishwasher broke. And I went into a big box store. And the first thing I was attracted to was the big yellow label that is certified from the FTC that essentially tells me about the efficiency of that particular appliance. So I'm curious to you, when we think about rating systems, we think about what we heard Mark talk about, talk to us about what is under the hood of these models and why they have sort of limited transparency that might require, I think what Mark is suggesting, a different conversation in addition to the suite of resources like impact assessments and audits, et cetera.
Yeah, such an important set of questions.
So, I hate you so much. I'm so sorry.
No, it's not to be sorry. It's a great set of questions. So I guess a couple things. So many, not all, but many of these algorithms are designed and produced by companies, commercial enterprises that are in the business to make profit. And they do so in part because they have a proprietary, or they believe they have a proprietary advantage in keeping, you know, in their algorithm. And obviously they would lose that if they just sort of, or some of them anyway, have a model where they would lose that if they just sort of opened it up to the world. So there's a trade, and you know, to be fair to companies, companies do have trade secret rights, and you know, the need, the absolute need, which I would agree with, to hold AI accountable does need to be addressed with, you know, due respect for trade secret rights. So many of these companies, you know, intentionally, not to be devious, but just because they're trying to preserve their commercial advantages, don't sort of dump their source code on the internet for the world to see. Another challenge is that just complexity, right? These are very, very complex algorithms. And so even putting aside the trade secret concerns, suppose a company said, okay, here, have at it. Here's, you know, 500,000 lines of code that's deciding who gets a loan and who doesn't. You know, it may not be easy to figure out, you know, what the algorithm is doing. It can be really, really hard, even when you have access to everything that's in the code, to know what it's doing. Now, one way around that is you could say, well, hey, if you're going to market this, you've got to give us, I don't know, a flow chart or something that tells us exactly how it works. The challenge I've seen with that sort of thing, not in this domain, but in others, and I have had quite a lot of experience actually comparing code to documents that purport to describe what the code does. And, you know, the person who does the flow chart isn't necessarily the person who writes the code, and they do the flow chart in, you know, 2017, and someone in 2019 writes the code, and then they leave, and someone in 2020, you know, updates it. And so the problem with looking at the code is that it's hard to understand. The problem with looking at the documents describing the code is that they're not the code. And so it's a really complicated question. The other thought I'll just, close with is that, there's a lot of dimensions, you know, to describing an algorithm. If you look at, you know, something like, I don't know, a dishwasher, you know, you care about things like how much power it uses and how much water it uses and maybe how much noise it makes, right? But there aren't that many kind of parameters that you need to know kind of, you know, what it's going to consume or use, right? Or how, what its impact is going to be. And with AI, of course, there's, you know, the dimensionality of the problem is much higher. And so if we do think about a rating system, you know, then there's a really important set of questions: how do we get there, right? Like what components go into that rating system? But it's a fascinating question, and I look forward to continuing to discuss it.
Oh yeah, we're going to get there, because I told these folks that when we get to this Energy Star rating that I purported, I know there's a couple people who are out there like, Nicole, I don't know about that. We're going to talk about it and just see, because this is part of a project that we're working on here at Brookings. Elham, I want to actually switch to you, because I mean, you're listening, you're at NIST, which is the entity that is responsible for standards, right? So you all don't do necessarily rulemaking that would sort of, suggest that there's something that's deceptive or, you know, out of the norm for an algorithm, but you actually do a lot of testing, right? And you think about the variables that are part of the inputs and the efficiencies as well as the performance of algorithms. What's your opinion? I mean, is one part of the question is, should we just stick with standards, right? And sort of trust the standards within the lab versus trusting the standards, how they operate in the real world? Or, you know, what's your opinion about imposing certifications or labeling or rating systems on algorithmic models?
Yeah, Nicole, thanks. Thanks for having me here. And good question. So as you said, NIST is a non-regulatory agency, and we have a broad portfolio of research. And in terms of AI, we're focusing on trustworthy AI. And picking up what John said, you know, what constitutes trustworthiness and different aspects and different technical requirements for trustworthy and how do we know they're trustworthy. But you use the word conformity assessment standard and certifications, and these are have special meanings, particularly to us. And I want to go through that, and in going through them, answer some of your questions. So conformity assessment program models vary based on balancing risk and resources. And the first thing I want to bring up here, and then I bring up again at the closing, is that one size fits all is not going to work. Conformity assessment is defined in ISO standard, and ISO standard, I think, 17000, as the demonstration that specified requirements relating to a product, process, system, person, or body are fulfilled. Now, each of these words are, you know, standard processes are being very carefully crafted. By requirements, we mean how should it perform. Requirement defines characteristics of the object of the conformity, and it can be expressed in various ways. Standard is one of them. So one challenge right now is, for example, you brought up the issue of the algorithmic bias. If we want to go and you know, how to write the requirements for bias, what do we mean by bias, how to measure them, what data to use to measure them. So these are the things that are lacking. And again, one size doesn't fit all. You measure bias for different use cases, application domains is going to be different. And then in the definition of the conformity assessment that I said, so it's a demonstration of specified requirements. Okay, to talk about requirements, what do we mean by determination? Determination is that how do we know it performs? So you need some sort of testing mechanism, inspection or audit, some way of knowing that it does what it says. Again, talking about standard, those things are lacking right now. We don't know how to test for existence of bias or lack of that in standard way. We don't know that for vulnerabilities of AI. We don't know that for explainability of AI. And then there is another part that attestation, that who says that the performance has been demonstrated. And it can be done, so attestation is usually a statement made by an organization, usually that the requirements have been fulfilled, right? If a manufacturer makes the attestation, it's called the supplier declaration of the conformity. If attestation is done by a third party, then it is a certification. So the first party, they're all, you know, I think these are the details that never have been discussed. So the first party is when the conformity assessment is performed by the person or organization that provide the product or service. This is a seller or manufacturer. Second party is the purchaser or user. And the third party is an independent entity that has no interest in transactions between the first and second party. So in terms of a certification or conformity assessment, the things that are missing are the requirements or the test methods on how to do testing. Another big thing is that not only we have a big, the dimensionality of the different things that has to be assessed, but also the specificity to the application domain and use case. Explainability may not be important for many applications, but very important for some other applications. I also want to say something about what Mark said about the history of that. So I'm glad that Mark also, I wrote it down about successful examples of rating, because right, it all depends on what are you trying to get out of those rating. Is it confidence? Is it a change of the user behavior? I think the intent is really good, but it's a really difficult problem to address.
Well, and I think that, Elham, what you actually demonstrated is why it's so difficult for us to do what John said, know what's under the hood, right? Because you have to run these series of tests. Sounds like what you're suggesting is at the production level, you know, at the user level, and then potentially at an independent audit level, where there's somebody who actually sees how the algorithm performs generally, right? It just appears to me, and Frida, let me go to you, because, I mean, you're on the tech development side. Like, you're a scientists, you're also a person who has a company that is doing employment algorithms, that performance matters, right? And that goes back to what Jason Oxman said, that if something breaks down on the car, most likely people aren't going to buy it again because they've lost the trust in the product. I would love to hear a little bit more about, you know, when you think about ratings and labels and certifications, the extent to which as a company that's doing this, that it actually matters or differentiates your product from others.
Yeah, sure. So we are 100% believers that, you know, tech companies have to be trustworthy and earn trust. It's not a given, right? So I'll just start there. And again, I spent 10 years in academia at Harvard and MIT as a cognitive neuroscientist before founding Pymetrics. And so I come to the problem of AI and machine learning with a different lens, meaning that I've studied the human brain for a decade prior to then thinking about algorithms. And, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, a human brain has lots of similarities to algorithms, right? It is a system. It has, it's a hardware system. It has operating systems to it, and so on and so forth. And so whenever I think about the systems we develop, I also think, what's the human corollary to this, right? So I would start by saying this. We 100% believe that, you know, tools like ours, companies like ours should subject themselves to some sort of certification standards and audits. And actually, we've already engaged in a third-party audit of our system, which, to your point, John, you can, you know, not reveal your source code, but you can still let a third disinterested party in there to attest that, you know, yes, indeed, they are doing what they're doing. So I think there is a way around this. It's not, you know, something that you can, it's, there's a way around it. The second thing I would say is that we believe that it's really important to audit outcomes, probably more so than process, because at the end of the day, you know, and not to say you shouldn't, there may be some process issues that you want to think about, but and again, we are explainable. We provide information about what we're looking at. So it's not that I don't believe in explainability or anything like that. It's just that I can explain all day long, but at the end of the day, it's sort of like having a nutritional label, but then I don't know, well, what is the recommended daily allowance of protein and fat, right? The nutritional label is not very helpful unless I have some sort of outcome that I'm looking for, right? So that's just the second thing I'd say. So we're big fans of auditing, including third-party audits of the outcomes more than the process. The other thing I'd like to say, which others have brought up, is that I don't believe there'll ever be an AI certification system for all AI, because it can be used so differently. And, you know, let's take employment. You know, there are certain things that are best practices among, you know, machine learning experts that are actually illegal in employment algorithms. So there just isn't a way that I think you could ever design a tool that says all AI must do this. And it really needs to be sort of application specific, which is what, you know, Elham raised. And then, you know, the last thing I would say is I think we have to, so if you think about audits have also been done of human behavior. And Sendhil Mullainathan, Cass Sustein, John Kleinberg, and Jens Ludwig wrote a great paper called AI as Discrimination Detectors. And they sort of start out this paper by saying, look, guys, we've done audit studies of employment. We've done audit studies of all these different human decision-making processes. And guess what? Humans are not doing so great. You know what I mean? So I think that when we think about auditing and we think about comparisons, my favorite analogy for what we might end up needing in certain cases for AI is something similar to an FDA-like structure. And actually, Joy Bulamini recommended this in her FRT paper. So I'm stealing it from her, but I'm going to give it props, because I think at the end of the day, if the FDA just said, well, let's look at drug A versus drug B, but never consider if we never gave the patient drug, what would that look like? That would be kind of a useless rating system, right? And to your point of dishwashers, you know, we're comparing dishwashers, but everyone has sort of agreed that a dishwasher is better than hand washing. We haven't gotten to that place with AI. We still think that the human process could be better. So I think that if we're still in that debate phase, and we absolutely are, we need to include the base case, which is like, hey, this is what humans do, right? Whether it's in giving out insurance or hiring or whatever, that's the base case. And then we can look at AI system 1, 2, 3, 4. And again, our recommendation is that it be, or our thinking is that it's best to focus on outcomes more so than process. So I'll pause there. I've said a lot. Thank you for that.
I love what all of you have said, because I think this is where I've gotten stuck as a sociologist, because I'm concerned, like policymakers, on the outcomes, right? So there's a lot of debate around where should you worry about what goes into the model, that garbage in, garbage out. But at the end of the day, you know, I think people want to see high performing algorithms, but they also want to see in certain use cases where those determinations do not discriminate or profile or surveil certain characteristics. Which brings me to like what we've seen in Germany, right? I mean, their AI label is basically being applied to particular use cases, which I think they're trying to apply a lot of the stuff that we're talking about. And I'm just curious from all of you, I mean, the Europeans seem to get ahead of us on a lot of this stuff. The extent to which, you know, are they giving us a pathway to follow, or is this just too prescriptive, you know, in terms of that medicine as to the labeling? Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I think that it's a good model, what the German authorities are calling for. And it's similar to what the EU is calling for in its proposed AI regulation, where they say the high-risk algorithms need a kind of pre-market clearance. And I don't think a single agency can do this. This is speaking to Frieda's point about all the issues are really algorithmic specific. And so I do think it has to be focused on the particular application, not on algorithms in general. That's much too broad. And of course, compared to what is the key question? You, if you're one of the alternatives is humans, you've got to use that as perhaps the baseline. Mm-hmm. And I agree the process has to be like drug approval. And from an industry perspective, that really is a much better way to do it, because the industry gets to conduct the analysis, right? They and that is then subject to a further regulatory review. For those of you who know something about the conduct of legitimate interest assessments under GDPR, it's similar to that, where if you're going to use legitimate interest as your legal basis for data processing, you've got to do a kind of cost-benefit analysis comparing what you're doing with the rights and interests of the data subjects. So I do think that's a good way to go forward. And let me tell you, if you don't do it, things can go wrong in very dramatic ways. One of my best anecdotes is the software that's widely used to allocate healthcare to hospital patients. One of them got on the market and it was used widely. Hundreds of millions of people were allocated healthcare. And yet, because of the way it was constructed, it was biased against Black patients. Black patients accounted only for 17% of the patients that were recommended for healthcare, but using an unbiased algorithm would have given 45% of the patients assigned would have been African American. So you know, conducting these analyses before the fact is crucial. The developer of that product never did it, and once they worked with the researcher to fix it, they improved the product dramatically. But that should have been done at the development stage, and so there needs to be a kind of risk assessment before these things go onto the market, so you can check to see if there's a better way of doing it than what the developer has actually developed.
Yeah, no, I love that. And actually, I want to put a pin in what you're talking about, because that algorithm, every time I think about it, it was like a front page story, because the variables that were used was the amount of money people invested in healthcare, and it kicked out Black patients as a result of that. But I want to hold that thought, because I want to see if anybody disagrees with Mark, right? In terms of the German model of actually looking at particular high risk algorithms and labeling them. I mean, do you all have agreement that that's the way to go, or is there some pushback on parts of that? Does it restrict innovation if we actually go that way? I'm just curious to hear from others.
I just repeat what I said for that one too. Well, the first thing is that how to decide something is high risk, and go back to the point of one size does not fit all. You may think that face recognition algorithm is high risk. Certainly, it's high risk for use of face recognition in law enforcement. But if I'm using face recognition to unlock my phone, maybe it's not high risk, right? So we cannot just coming up with the label of high risk and then applying it correctly is difficult. And then the other thing is that the other big question is that whether the needed knowledge base and infrastructure to come up with a robust labeling scheme for AI currently exists. And then the consequence of that is that how we can ensure that it does not create a false sense of confidence. So it again goes back to what we really expect to happen with these things. If we want to get user confidence, then we ought to be to have some good sense of how we're going to do it, so that we are not creating false sense of confidence or a lack of confidence. So that was just my point about do we have the right scientific foundations to do this at this time?
I love this. Anybody else? And wait, before we actually go, tweet, please, folks, AI bias, because this conversation is really actually really interesting. Yeah. AI bias is the tweet. And if you have questions, events@brookings.edu. Go ahead, Frida.
Nicole, I just want to say something around innovation. I think I made that point when I was hugely pregnant on the panel that we did together. Look, I definitely think that regulation is an issue, but quite frankly, employment is already highly regulated. So, you know, if you're developing algorithms in employment, you're already subject to all sorts of regulations. So that's one thing. The second thing is I actually think that if you look at the Fair Credit Reporting Act of 1974, that is an excellent example so I'm married to somebody who in finance who thinks regulation, you know, is the spawn of the devil. But, you know, if you look at that, it actually showcases an instance where industry blossomed because there was regulation put in place that basically then, you know, yielded public confidence in a product and a whole industry that had not been there before. And quite frankly, I think we're there with AI. I think there's very low public confidence. I actually think that if we had some sensible, and it has to be sensible, and I've seen instances of what I would consider not sensible, you know, regulation, I actually think that it could benefit both consumers, employers, and makers of AI. So I think there's a path forward. It just, you know, it has to be done well, I think. So
No, I love this so far. John, I want to go back to you in the respect to, as I told you, I have questions, but the way this conversation is going, I mean, it seems to me that, and I think both Frida, Mark, and Elham are sort of bringing it up. Are we talking about rating systems? Are we talking about labels? Are we talking about underwriting, right? And you've done a lot of great work on underwriting of algorithms just to determine, you know, if any type of bias liability or something that comes out of the model is unpredicted, right? And has an unintended consequence. Do you think that actually should be part of this conversation in terms of the underwriting of the algorithm? Or are we in the right lane when we start talking about these processes to basically assess, you know, the performance of a model?
All right. Well, it's a complicated question. I guess one of the things I'd say is upstream from all of this, you know, we would all, everyone, or at least all reasonable people would agree that we don't want our algorithms to be unfair or to be biased. But, you know, one immediate challenge once we all agree to that is, well, what do we mean by biased, right? And there's, you know, there's different mathematical definitions. There's, you know, equalized odds. There's predictive parity. There's statistical parity. There's any number of these measures. And one of the challenges, and reasonable people can make reasonable arguments in favor of or against any of these, any of these measures. You know, the challenge is sort of how do you make the decision about the sort of metric you're going to use to assess these algorithms? And then how do you educate the public? Like I said, if I'm going into a big box store buying the dryer, you know, I just want to know, it's a simple, I want to know how much power it uses, right? If I'm buying an algorithm, I don't want somebody to say, well, here's seven pages of equations that tells you, I mean, I just don't want to know that, right? And so we've got to sort of figure out on the one way to kind of balance the just inherent complexity of the space and the sort of lack of simplicity, you know, that these questions, you know, force us to confront with the need. I mean, the whole, I would, you know, Nicole, you correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the whole points of your desire, which is totally reasonable, is you want to kind of communicate, you want to convey, right? You don't want people to have a PhD in machine learning to understand if this thing's working enough, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the right thing to do to have these conversations. I just want to make sure that when we do that, we sort of look at the full chain, right? And then once we do that, if we can agree that, you know, predictive parity is the way to measure presence or absence of bias, then it's actually not too hard to do that. And you might not even need to get inside the code. You might be able to just put a bunch of inputs in and look at a bunch of outputs and say, hey, it's working for these two or three or 10 groups of people.
Yeah. And John, I would just add to that, though, like in employment, there is a legal definition of bias, right? So we don't actually have to reinvent the wheel. And actually, it would be, you would not want to do that because you might actually conflict with the law. So, well, and again, I don't.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, sure.
It's a super interesting point. So, you know, there's, you know, in discrimination law, I agree with you. Like, there's disparate treatment and there's disparate impact, right?
The only thing that's legally regulated by Title VII is disparate impact, just as an FYI. So, like, it's
I guess, you know, the courts have traditionally, for all sorts of discrimination law, looked at disparate treatment and disparate impact. I mean,
is really by OFCCP and EEOC standards, disparate impact is the standard. Again, we can talk to our head of policy who came from EEOC. So, but anyway,
I guess my point was that, let's, as a, the point I was trying to make is that as a hypothetical, if there's disparate treatment, one of the way you could rectify that is you could go and turn a dial to fix it. But in turning that dial, you might generate disparate impact. Right?
Yes.
And vice versa, by the way. And so I'm just pointing out that these legal frameworks, you know, can collide with kind of the mathematical kind of, you know, kind of paradoxes you can find yourselves in when you sort of try to fix one problem and find out that all of a sudden you've fallen into legal jeopardy, despite having...
But all I want to say, right, is that the definition of adverse impact, which is bias in employment, is all around whether disparate impact has failed. Disparate treatment is something else you might want to look at, but there's no... Title VII doesn't really talk about disparate treatment. And I just think it's important because I think there is a lot of confusion out there. Oh, if we do this and that, if we do this and that. Actually, in hiring, it's fairly clear. So I don't think there's that much confusion in hiring. In other spaces, there may be. But I think that there are some clear definitions as per sort of federal rights.
So if I can jump in. So it's good that you have a clear definition for bias as a disparate impact for the hiring. But that, and I think that's another challenge, that cannot be applied or expanded to other domains.
Right.
Because sometimes the algorithm is designed to not have the uniform impact, you know, car insurance, right? So you don't want everybody to pay it. So that again goes back to the problem of if you don't have one size fits all, then makes it a lot more difficult. And one other thing that I want to add to what John said about there's a lot of things to consider. Another issue is that they also conflate with each other. So you improve explainability, you may get a hit on accuracy or security, and bias goes hand in hand. So how do we do it that it's right, it's interpretable, and it doesn't create a false sense of confidence.
Mark, I knew you were going to come in, so go ahead, and then I'm talking about my model, because that's what Mark
and I bet. a quick point on, you know, sometimes these different definitions, they have to be context specific. It can't be one size fits all, as people have been saying over and over again. And sometimes the kind of information that has to be revealed either by a rating system or just some kind of labeling system is very, very specific to the use of the algorithm. My favorite example comes from confounding treatment variables, which can be hidden in machine learning programs. My best example is the lower risk of fatal outcomes for heart attack patients who are also asthma victims. This correlation, it arises precisely because asthma patients are at a higher risk when they get a heart attack, and so they get the hospitalization. Now, it would be fatal to use that algorithm for treatment decisions. It would kill people, literally. So for this reason, the researchers really have to, you know, be made aware that that kind of confounding treatment variable might be hidden in the formula. And some researchers say don't even use those kind of formulas for treatment algorithms. Now, this could be dealt with by labeling, right? You could have something that says not recommended for treatment purposes, right? But also for experts, you might need to go to the next layer of detail and tell them what the statistical technique that was used in that system would be. That wouldn't be useful for ordinary people. It wouldn't even be useful for doctors. But for researchers, it would be essential if they wanted to get a handle on what that algorithm really was all about and how it might be improved.
Now, John, I know you're working on, and I want to go to my model, but I know you are working on a paper like this for Brookings and for your general research in terms of disparate impact, disparate treatment. You want to just talk a little bit about that? And for the people who are watching, I'm sure it'll be available soon, but I promise to all of you, and Frieda will have you back, this part of that conversation is so important that we have to really disentangle that as we look at AI bias.
Well, yeah, I have a paper in another area, the Fair Housing Act. HUD has just issued a final version of a rule on interpreting disparate impact, you know, liability under the FHA. And notably, for the first time, I think probably ever in the rulemaking, at least certainly in HUD, it has a specific section about how cases where there's alleged algorithmic bias in, you know, the types of transactions that are protected under the FHA, you know, loan approvals and marketing and advertising, how those are going to be addressed. And frankly, I find it personally a very concerning framework, because it puts a very significant hurdle in front of a plaintiff who, you know, basically requiring, as I read it anyway, a plaintiff who wants to move forward in the case to sort of put up more information than they would likely have prior to discovery, right? And so, but then the problem is, if they don't cross that hurdle in the pleading stage, then they would perhaps never get to the discovery phase where they could actually get the information they, in theory, needed at the pleading stage. And so it's just, you know, it's a very important topic, both in the housing sector and more generally, because we see now the government moving, as far as I know, for the first direction to sort of lay down, you know, through the rulemaking process, rules specifically addressing algorithms. And in this case, one that is not particularly conducive to people, plaintiffs in disparate impact at housing cases who have legitimate concerns about discrimination. Anyway, yeah, I've got a law review article that's coming out in a couple of months on that, and I'm sure I'll do a little post about it in the Brookings site at that point.
It's all good. It's all good. Go ahead, Mark. And then, I mean, I want to talk about my model too, guys. So, Mark, you go ahead. And then we'll
one quick comment is that the HUD's final rule was through a lot of that stuff on sort of a free pass for standard algorithms.
Yeah.
And all to the good. I mean, the previous thing was just an insult to the cause of racial justice. So I think what they finally came out with might have avoided the worst aspects of what they initially proposed.
Well, I'm going to make a polite rebuttal to that is that it's true there is sort of a carve out or a get out of jail free card for, you know, if your algorithm is sort of standard in some form. But the question is, who defines that, right?
Right.
And it also, and interestingly, it sort of allows people to sort of duck responsibility if they can kind of point upstream in the supply chain. You know, and if a car maker sells a car and the brakes fail and there's an accident and somebody sues the car maker can't say, well, not our issue because, you know, we bought the brakes from somebody else. But in the algorithm world, it appears at least, you know, that there is a little bit of a move to sort of formalizing frameworks that could allow people to kind of, you know, kick the responsibility upstream somewhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, okay, so let me go in real quickly. I think I see another panel coming out of this, because I think that's why I'm doing this panel and that's why we're having this discussion. So when I started this work, you know, again, going back to my colleagues on that first paper that we did a couple of years ago, it was about, well, do we need a housekeeping seal? Because obviously lay people can't look under the hood. Companies have to compete for the interest in the marketplace. And at the end of the day, you do not want algorithms that are illegal or unlawfully discriminate against you, nor do you want algorithms that, if they cannot perform, for example, facial recognition technologies, cannot recognize dark skin complexions, or people like me, whose last week hair was curly and today my hair is straight, tell me, because that actually impacts the performance. And I was thinking with that dishwasher example, and I see people online are picking up on this, we have every single rating system when it comes to commerce. We have systems that we comment on in terms of hotels. We let people know what we feel about X. In the opacity of the internet, there is no way for you to know whether or not an algorithm performed the same way if you were a woman, if you were a man, if you were African-American, if you were Latina, if you were light-skinned, or you were dark-skinned. And to me, that's why I think there's a couple things that can come out of this. So far, I think many of you have said, we might want to consider a rating system if we are looking at companies to sort of put in their best practices and we sort of fair them against each other. That's one step. Some of you have said, well, maybe it's good to have a rating system or labeling system because at least you know what's in the ingredient. Maybe it's disclosed that certain facial recognition will not pick up on Black women whose hair changes or women whose hair changes. Maybe it goes back to Elham said, right? This is okay for opening your phone, but it's not okay for driving a car, right? And then maybe the third piece is, which I'm actually trying to dig into a little bit more, what's the feedback loop if you actually recognize that algorithms are generally biased in some way because it represents the values, the norms, the assumptions. If you understand that there'll be some algorithms that will have conformity to civil rights laws where it's really clear what you cannot do and others that do not. Mm-hmm. But then you also understand that the algorithm outside of the lab will perform differently on different subjects. How can you have rating systems that are maybe generated by individual users, which is my Energy Star rating idea, that may be more about process, that you're actually able to increase the performance because you're getting feedback that this algorithm is not optimized for diversity, or it's not optimized for, you know, women's pain thresholds over men because the sample is not well designed. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just putting it out there. I mean, I in no way, I'm a social scientist. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not any of those things. But what I do think matters is that we have to have some way to assess both for private sector developers, as well as academics and users, that this algorithm is going to be designed to do what you think it's going to do, or it's not, so that people can make choices in the marketplace. So Frida, I want to go to you. I mean, if you had something like this, I mean, obviously you want people to know that Pyometrics is like a boss algorithm for employment, and you want to keep competing for that. That's that first level. But what about giving a feedback loop for people to chime in once they know that you've done all you can, right, to make sure that a performance is optimized?
Sure. So the one thing I will say, so if you had to guess how many people think they're less biased than other people, what do you think the percentage is?
A lot, probably.
It's 80%. It's 80%. So my point is that, you know, as a person that studied the human brain for 10 years, my only concern is that we don't judge things accurately oftentimes, especially when the if my dishwasher breaks, totally, I get it. My dishwasher breaks, right? If this algorithm treated me fairly or not, you know, I think that might just fall prey to some of the, you know, challenges of really understanding whether something, don't get me wrong. I think there absolutely should be a feedback loop and there absolutely should be fair. I'm not trying to say that, but what if, I don't know, like some algorithm does something that interspaces with the user in a way that for whatever reason they don't like, and therefore they don't like it, but actually the outcome is better than some, I'm just imagining, algorithm that goes out of their way to be pretty and nice and this and the other, like to the, you know, visually, but actually is hugely discriminatory. So my point is just, I think that in getting these rating systems, and I'm not trying to like, you know, denigrate users as, or people as being somehow not capable of rating things. I just worry about what they would be rating it. What feedback would they actually, what thing would they be rating it on? And that's what I would worry about, because then I think people would fall prey to deceptive marketing, quite frankly. And we've already seen that, right? Oh, my algorithm is, you know, unbiased or this and that and the other. Well, prove it. Well, I can't prove it to you, but I'm telling you that it is. And what if a lot of people were to believe that and then just give that company good ratings, you know, with no proof? So that's my biggest concern around consumer ratings. It would just be like, let's make sure that they can definitely have objective data that they're looking at.
No, I mean, that's fair, right? We've litigated that on the Hill in terms of ratings of products and services. So I appreciate that. Who else? I mean, when you think about that, and we got tons of questions, so I don't want you to spend too much time on my research. For those of you that are watching, it's in the beginning stages. I've done about 12 or 15 interviews with different companies and developers trying to come up and nuance this. So please send me feedback at my Twitter account or email, but I want to make sure I get to everybody's questions. Anybody else have a response to where we sort of land up on the ratings question, or where it might be more necessary or useful? This is the first time this group has been this quiet. I think everybody's pleading the fifth, which is okay. So I can jump right into questions. Let me go to questions then. And again, this is I appreciate the feedback, because I think everything that we talked about also has myself as a scholar just sort of thinking about where is the rating most effective, right? And is it process? Is it enforcement? Is it at the civil rights side? Is it use cases? So thank you. So I want to go to Lori Dowling, my friend Lori, who always comes to our stuff on AI, and she's particularly interested in employment. Her question is, I do love the idea of a rating system. Thank you, Lori. Thank you. Thank you. And I'd assume, like the dishwasher, you can list the key characteristics and have manufacturers confirm that they meet them. But as to bias and our use in hiring, how can we know what's under the hood in that instance? And that's of importance to HR.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, I think that this is where it's all about looking at outcomes, right? And I actually think that and, you know, John, I'm sure that in looking at the law, you'll appreciate this. I actually think that if you have an AI system in place, it actually is leaving a paper trail of how decisions are being made, which, you know, for better or worse, that's not actually happening a lot of times when human beings are making a decision. So, you know, there are definitely management side attorneys that will say, hey, putting in an AI system, even if it's less biased than your human system, is more risky because you're leaving a paper trail. But I actually think that's the advantage. And that's the claim that this paper makes, you know, algorithms as discrimination detectors, is that they could actually be used as social justice tools because they're leaving paper trails of decision making, which we don't currently have when we rely solely on human judgment. So to the question just asked, there is the ability to examine that paper trail. I think what is in the way is, you know, that it's a very legally fraught area. And therefore, you know, you might get into an argument between plaintiff and management side attorneys as to if we were to design some regulation that made transparency, you know, more at the forefront, I think that, you know, that we've seen, you know, sort of a clash between two groups of lawyers that tend to want different things. And therefore, how do we kind of get around that? But I think if you look at the Equal Pay Act in Massachusetts, I think that's a good model, right? Because it said, look at your equal pay. If there is a problem, you have a grace period of a couple of years to be able to fix that. And I think unless we have something similar to that, where you are encouraging people to look at this data, encouraging people to look at how these algorithms are impacting folks. And then if there's a problem fixing it, I think that's a good model for how you could move forward. That's just my opinion, obviously.
Yeah, I guess I would just chime in. Like, I agree with your really good points. And I'm skeptical of the assertion that, you know, hey, a paper trail is a bad idea because it might create, you know, more liability.
I don't agree with that. I've just heard it. Yeah.
Yeah, if the paper trail can help, you know, identify and expose biases that would have otherwise gone undetected, then, you know, yeah, maybe at the beginning there'd be some people who would be held liable for it, but the system would sort of recalibrate to correct for those things.
You're preaching to the choir. But I'm just telling you, I've heard management side attorneys.
I'm sure you have, but their job is, you know, they view their job perhaps when they're saying that as just protecting the companies from litigation, you know, whereas I think we're standing back, we're saying, you know, how can we bring fairer systems to, you know,
The rubber meets the road, it's those management side attorneys that are then giving guidance to these companies as to whether they should continue with a clearly biased human process or potentially put in an unbiased AI system that, you know, occasionally might actually trip the bias wire, but and that would leave them more legally liable.
Or a combination, right? I mean, a combination, a human informed decision, you know, informed by
absolutely. I'm just telling you the challenges we've seen in trying to implement, you know, less biased technologies that these are the arguments we've heard. So,
and it's hard. I mean, it's generally hard to actually have this conversation and to sort of have this conversation between technical experts as well as lawyers, as well as sociologists all sitting around trying to figure it out. The paper that I referenced took almost a year to actually do for this very reason. So I love the fact that I'm simulating the reason why this is such an important conversation to have. Elham, Henry Weber has a question for you. His question is, could you discuss how NIST recently introduced four principles for explainable AI could be utilized in different rating systems proposals? And he recognizes that evaluating outcomes helps to work towards accountability, but believes that explainable AI might help bolster consumer buy-in to a standard or cert. So hopefully you got that.
Thank you for the question. The paper that we put out, yes, we put the paper out for principle of explainable AI, and that's out for comment by October 15. So please let us know your input, thoughts, and comments about the paper. Explainable AI explainability of AI is a difficult and complicated topic because you don't need explainability for every possible scenario for recommender systems. For example, that's telling me which movie to watch based on my history of watching movie. I really don't need explanations, but there are some applications that you do need explanations. And particularly, explanations play a role when something goes wrong and you want to do course corrections. Not to mention that there are also some legal requirements for explainability. So what is explainability? What expectations of an explainable AI systems? What's the expectations of the explainability to be correct, to be within the scope of the model that was trained for the particular intent, particular use? The paper talks about all of these things. And we use the word explainability, but we are also very aware that explainability and interpretability are these two terms are being used differently among different communities. So you may need back to what John was saying at the very beginning, you may not need to know exactly what's going under the hood. It may not be useful information to a lot of the people interact with the systems, but it might be very important to the computer scientists and the people that are developing those models. Those are explainability, you know, figuring out what's under the hood, how the model works. And the interpretability is how to get the outcome and how to talk about how this prediction was made, how the recommendation was made, what factor was involved in making the outcome of the AI system. So that was the paper, and this is a true consultation. It's certainly not completely addressed the issue of the explainability, so we're really looking forward to community engagement. How it relates to the labeling. So it again really goes back, as it was mentioned, there's a lot of things that a label or a rating system can achieve. And today, a lot of these things have been mentioned. The label can just go and rate, is it safe to use? Is it biased? Is it reliable? Should I use it for this particular application or for other ones? The explainability can help with information about how the decision was made and if there is any of these different intent of the labeling system that was discussed, it can help. It may be help with that. But again, I think we are trying to pack too many things under the label or rating systems. And these are all important discussions. I'm just trying to figure out how to do that. What you said about in the explainable paper, one of the principles is a knowledge limit. And Nicole, you mentioned that we want to have something that don't use it for this purpose, right? Or this face recognition does not work for this particular populations. I see them different than, certainly it's not rating, right? So it's extra information. And I think those can be very useful. I don't know if I answered the questions, but that's what I have to say.
And that paper is available at NIST, right, Elham? So somebody can get that paper at NIST?
Yes. I can send you the link if you want to.
Perfect. Now, Mark, I got a question for you, and then I'm going to wrap up. Regarding your reference to the second wave of AI accountability, there are clear reasons for investment in AI safety and management. What would you say are the most concrete reasons, and how do they compare to market-driven incentives for AI development and deployment? That is, sell as many units as possible and focus investment on R&D. In America, AI stakeholders seem to be more incentivized to invent and sell than to test and regulate. So our friend Tom Wheeler, who is in CTI, the department which I run, always says that it's about breaking things now and fixing it later. It's basically a summary of that question. So are there incentives to actually get folks to start thinking about, you know, these types of best practices before we jump to regulation?
Are there incentives? I'm sure there might be, and I think we should explore them. But I'm skeptical that any of them will do any good without the weight of government action behind it, or at least the threat of government action behind it. The example I showed before of getting a health management algorithm out into the marketplace as fast as possible suggests that marketplace incentives, you know, really are pretty powerful in this circumstance. And the sort of the thrust of tech development over the last 20 years, especially, is really, you know, get it out there as fast as possible and then see if it needs to be fixed. Well, you know, for a recommendation engine, why not? But for a healthcare management algorithm, that's just the wrong style of development. And I do think without some sort of government management role, the marketplace will tend to move in that direction with dangerous results, and results that I think could be avoidable with a sensible and thoughtful government regulatory role.
Well, and in 10 seconds, Frida, because this actually was to you, in terms of then the laws that we have, are they sort of imperfectly designed to stave off some of the threats that we talked about today when it comes to AI?
Oh, I don't know about that. I wouldn't say that. I think they can always be improved upon, quite frankly. But I wouldn't say that existing law is problematic. I think that it's always room for improvement. But I actually think it's a really good start. So no, not at all.
Okay. So John has a paper coming out. We heard from a tech developer who's out there actually trying to figure out how to make her products comply with employment laws. We've heard from the person who is standardizing this technology. And then I love the way Mark is just sitting back, listening to everybody and offering his advice, as he does so well when it comes to really thinking about the evolution of technology from his role and the Software Association to what he does now at Georgetown, and even the stuff he contributes to Brookings. Friends, this is an issue and it's a challenge. And I think we would not have had this had we not realized that as we begin to see just how much we have of people's currency of data, that it matters, right? And it matters in ways that will create either productive processes or best practices on the technical side, or it has the potential to engender more harm or create more deceptiveness. At the end of the day, I swear I go back to my dishwasher model, that at some point, whether it's AI across industries or within similar industries or for consumers to people, I'm still trying to figure it out. We need some way to either gather data from individuals that this AI is optimized to their context, or we need to let people know that it's not, or let people tell us that it's not. Because my fear is this: it's not so much that AI is not doing a kick butt job when it comes to human improving upon human decision making, but as Frida said earlier, it needs humans in the loop to ensure that there are people who are not left behind, sure, because the variables that are maximized for just didn't include, you know, their attributes. So with that being in mind, please follow Tech Tank, our podcast. We actually have a podcast on that now, on racial bias in tech, as well as a whole lot of other podcasts of interest to this community. Please continue to follow us on our AI bias work at Brookings. Follow us from the homepage, hit AI. You'll see a whole host of papers and all the streams that we talked about, including several people on here. And please, I think some of you heard my dog. If nobody else cares about my rating system, she did. And so with that, I would just say have a great afternoon, and we will see you back at this place in Brookings space around these kind of conversations. Thank you, everyone, for giving us your hour. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, everyone.
Bye.